Welcome to the Run Nerd Library Podcast, a podcast for those who eat, sleep, breathe, train, think, talk, and read about running, and those who are curious. I'm the host, Don Hahn, a self-proclaimed run nerd. I consider myself more of a running enthusiast than an expert, fueled by coffee and blind optimism. This podcast will feature running experts talking about their books, and enthusiasts like me who are here to discuss their books with them. Whether you're listening on your commute or on your run, we are happy to have you here. Hello, listeners, and welcome back to the Run Nerd Library Podcast. I'm your host, Don Hahn, and my guest today is award-winning author Neil Bascom, a New York Times bestselling author with 14 nonfiction narratives, all focused on inspiring stories of adventure and achievement. Neil, you're specifically here today to talk about some of your running titles, including The Perfect Mile and Race of the Century. I think our listeners would love to get to know more about you. Can you give us a little bit of background on your involvement in running and sport? Also, how did you get started in writing?
Sure. At least in terms of sport and running, I grew up as a hockey player, probably from the time I was 4 years old, very early, and was pretty competitive in hockey as well as tennis. And right before ninth grade, I remember my father telling me that he thought that running cross country would be a sort of good pre-training for hockey season. And so I went out for the cross country team and just absolutely loved the sport. I loved the training, the running, the sort of camaraderie with my teammates. And so running I really, to that point, I would not have called myself a runner at all. Mm-hmm. And I caught the bug very quickly at that sort of tender age of 14, 15. And now, how many years later, 36, 37 years later, I'm still running a great deal, and I consider it sort of integral to my life.
Absolutely. And it was your father inspiring you to put on the tennis shoes and go out and get the running shoes and go out and give it a try. That's a great way to get introduced to the sport. And I guess in a lot of ways, complementary to hockey, with cardiovascular endurance being a key to hockey as well. So did those two sports kind of marry together a little bit?
They did, but in the sense that running, you know, hockey is a very team-oriented sport. It's something that you are constantly in interplay with your teammates. And what I enjoyed about running was in some respects the solo nature of it. The fact that I could be as good as the effort that I put into it. And I love that sort of sense of control that running gives you. And I think, you know, my fellow runners probably can align themselves with that, particularly the training that you determine your performance, and that's a nice thing.
Yeah, certainly the loneliness of the long distance runner as you're out there pounding the pavement and making your way towards those goals, for sure. What are some of the highlights of your running career?
Yeah, I mean, I would say I've done a couple of marathons, which were wonderful. My probably favorite marathon was the Marine Marathon in Washington, D.C. That was definitely a highlight. But for me, the sort of highlights of running actually come in just the experience of going out on the trail. Trail running in particular for me I can remember some of the sort of finest, sort of most engaged, present moments of my life happened when I just went out for a run. So for instance, I remember one time in Italy, with my young family at the time, and just going out on a sort of 5 miler up into the hills right after the sun rose, and just recall that sort of sense of just sublime glory that I felt. I mean, I definitely was experiencing running as high, you know, chemically probably, but it was just that, you know, the cadence and the moment and the scenery and being by myself out outdoors. So those moments, many of them, I can touch in my mind from runs all around the world.
I think that all the listeners probably can relate to that certain Zen run that they've had in their own lives. And I often go back to runs in the snow where you have the crushing of the snow underneath your steps and then the almost silence and serenity of the air around you as you know, just calm and peaceful. So certainly I can relate to that.
That's wonderful. So I've never actually done much snow running, so I have to give that a shot.
Oh, for sure. I think it's, especially if it's a freshly fallen snow and you can track your footsteps on the way out and back on your run. So
that's awesome. It's
a great experience. Let's talk about how you got into writing. So what did that look like for you? And have you always been sort of a keen student of history? How do those things play together?
Yeah, I mean, I've wanted to be a writer. Absolutely. Annoying to my own children now, who are, you know, in their ones off to college, and she doesn't know what she wants to major in. She's like, it was easy for you. You knew exactly what you wanted to do. and that, you know, from probably sixth or seventh grade, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to, you know, I was writing book reviews and computer game reviews and sending them magazines when I was, you know, 13 years old. So it was something that I always wanted to do, I wanted to write books. I didn't know what shape that would take, and I was a journalist right after school overseas, and I thought that was going to be my route towards writing. And then I started at a book publishing company as an editor, sort of learning the ropes of how to write a book. And again, I thought that I would write novels. And I wrote three or four really terrible novels in my 20s and really wasn't going anywhere. And then a friend of mine suggested this story about skyscrapers in New York. He knew I was big into architecture. I was living in New York at the time. And it was this tremendous story about these two architects who were battling each other in 1929 to design and build the tallest skyscraper in the world. It's a true story of the Chrysler Building as well as the Bank of Manhattan Building, and then thrown into the mix ultimately would be the Empire State Building. And it was history, and I wrote up a proposal, and it just felt natural to me. It was like the right form and style, and it just, all the pieces seemed to fall in place, and I sold that book sort of straight away, and it did reasonably well. And suddenly I was writing history, and I don't really consider myself a historian, more as a narrative writer. And, you know, but I love historical stories. And so I sort of combined those two elements.
Wow. And we're all certainly glad you did, because when we come back for the next segment, we're going to talk about your book, The Perfect Mile, which is a book that on my personal Mount Rushmore of running related titles, it is definitely on that list. That's, you know, the short list of the top four or five books that I would recommend to every runner to make sure you have a copy on your bookshelf. So we'll come right back. And in the next segment, we'll dive into The Perfect Mile. Okay, we are back with Neil Bascom, the author of The Perfect Mile and Race of the Century. Neil, I described your book as part of my personal sort of top echelon, top five, Mount Rushmore, if you will, of running-related books. It's a book that when I read parts of it and I listened to parts of it on audio, and that was on CD as I was driving, in my sales territory. I would listen to parts of that, and then I would read some in the evening as well. And I'll tell you, the way that you crafted the story, and we'll get into, I'll let you describe the story itself and the protagonists of the story. The way you describe the story, in listening to it and reading it, for me, it was as if I was part of everything that was going on at the time. The way that you describe things, very impactful, and you have a way of doing it in such a conversational tone that I feel like I'm part of the experience. So could you kind of, let's jump into the Perfect Mile. Give us your overview of what the title is about, and then we'll kind of dive into how it came to be.
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say thank you for those very kind words about the Perfect Mile, which, you know, you're not supposed to have favorite books, like you're not supposed to have favorite children, mm-hmm. but I have to say The Perfect Mile is probably in my top three of all the books that I've written and certainly researched. The story is, you know, rather simple. It's the story about the endeavor to be the first person in the world to break the 4-minute mile. And there's a long history of the 4-minute mile dating back to the 19th century and efforts to break it. And sort of overwhelmingly, there was this idea or this myth that to perform the 4-minute mile was risking life and limb, that simply the body couldn't do it. Now, many of the racers who sort of chiseled down to 4 minutes knew that that wasn't the case. But there was this aura around this 4 laps of the track in less than 4 minutes. And so mm-hmm. The Perfect Mile follows the story specifically of three runners, Roger Bannister from England, Wes Santee from Kansas, USA, and John Landy from the Melbourne area of Australia. And the three runners in 1952 all participated or went to the Helsinki Olympics. And for them, it was just a disaster, right? All three athletes came back. They didn't do well. They didn't live up to their expectations. And so individually, separately, they each decided that in order to overcome that disaster, they had to do something big. And that big mission was ultimately to break the 4-minute mile. And so you have in the fall of 1952, these three milers from three different continents, not racing against each other, all seeking this sort of unbreakable barrier. Mm-hmm. And so the story of the Perfect Mile is the story over 2 years of these three runners racing against each other on these different continents, all trying to be that first person.
And quite a challenge, you know, as you look at the ability of the human body to accomplish tasks or certain feats, like you mentioned, the 4-minute mile was one of those pedestals, and Alan Webb, the current American record holder, considers it almost a rite of passage for the milers to, you know, to be included in that classification of top milers to get past that 4-minute mile. And certainly at the time that these men were attempting this feat, you look at the conditions that they were running in, certainly different than today. You know, running on cinder tracks, the equipment that they had was not the same as today. So kind of talk to the audience, if you could, about in your conversations with those gentlemen, what that looked like for them as they were building up and as they were on, as you said, separate continents, but all trying to achieve the same goal.
So they each... What I loved about this story is that that each one of these individuals was very different than the other. Mm-hmm. They were pursuing this endeavor in very different ways. They had very different responsibilities in life and sport. And so just to sort of give you an idea of what that looks like, you have Roger Bannister, right? Went educated at Oxford, was this sort of pinnacle of the amateur athlete, you know, the sort of effortless superiority, the idea that one was to perform great athletic feats, but not look like you're trying very hard to do that. Mm-hmm. And basically for Bannister, what that meant was that he was not a full-time athlete. He was a part-time athlete. He was a full-time student, you know, doctor learning to practice medicine. And so his training was, you know, a half hour during lunch or an hour during lunch, he would bop out to the Iffley Road or to the track near his St. Mary's track near his hospital in London and do laps around the track. And it was much more intense than that as time developed. But when you look at Roger Bannister, you look at that kind of individual, someone who, you know, is this amateur doing these remarkable things. You have Wes Santee, who all three of these athletes were amateur athletes, but Wes Santee, Kansas, he was a collegiate athlete. His life was running. He got a scholarship to Kansas from his farm by virtue of his running. And he was obligated to perform, you know, cross country, track, all kinds of races all the time for his college. He had a coach, and this was very much his life, almost completely. And then you have John, and he was competing against other colleges and other athletes and just, you know, these big arenas. And he had this, a sort of national presence in many ways. And then you have John Landy, who is essentially in Melbourne, Australia, training on his own or just running mile after mile after mile with a sort of very strange Spartan-like coach named Percy Cerruti. And Landy was really all about will and putting in the miles, not really running races, but just training. Mm-hmm. And so that's a long answer to say that they each were pursuing their own methods. None of these methods were particularly advanced as we would consider them today. And they were largely figuring it out as they went, how to train their bodies and train their minds to perform four laps under 4 minutes.
A lot of experimentation going on at the time. It's certainly not the rich history that we have today of running related books and biomechanics studies and things along those lines. So you were actually with Bannister, with Santee, and with Landy at various points during the process of writing this book. What was that experience like for you? And can you kind of give us an idea of what the personalities of like you said, those three distinctly different individuals, what their personalities were like?
Sure. I mean, this was very much for me a sort of a dream come true, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I was first introduced to the story of the 4 minute mile back on that cross country team as a freshman in high school. Was suggested to read Bannister's memoir of his experience of breaking the four minute mile, and that was really all that had been written about it. To be perfectly honest, I mean, there was really not much else beyond the sort of contemporaneous accounts of him doing it. And so, the trick of this book was to get into the heads of each one of these athletes. And the only way to do that was to go and meet them and sit down with them and talk with them. And so fortunately, all three, you know, I was researching this shortly before the 50th anniversary. So it was kind of the perfect time because they weren't yet inundated with 50th anniversary interviews. And this was a year and a half before that. And so they were talking about their experience to me in a way that, you know, they hadn't in quite some time. And so, you know, I met each one of them. They were distinct as their training methods. Bannister was a super aggressive interview subject. He was probably one of the most aggressive I've ever experienced. I mean, he spent the first 20 to 30 minutes of our interview asking me questions about what I knew about his era of running and what he did. To sort of begin to trust me that I was going to be able to tell this story accurately and that was my intention. But, you know, ultimately, you know, convinced him I was serious. He kind of eased up a little bit. But, you know, we spent many hours together, both in London. And then I met him out in Oxford, where he also lived, walked around Iffley Road track where he broke the 4 minute mile. And, you know, you could sense that it felt very real to him. He had become this enormously famous person because of this achievement. But the fact is, back when he was doing it on this cinder track that he had helped build with Oxford University. And it was something that he sort of cobbled together on his own. So it was nice seeing that contrast between this sort of epic, you know, mountain of a person, and then, you know, what you envisioned him in his early 20s as a young man. Wes Santee was one of those people who wears his heart on his sleeves. He was very open. He was very emotional. He, you know, I think suffered a great deal in not achieving the 4-minute mile, not to wait to give away the boat too much. and still carried that disappointment with him 50 years later. I mean, I recall him weeping, talking about it, how close he got, and how many impediments were put in front of him to block him. And you could sense that disappointment, sense that anger again, half a century later. He was a lovely man. Again, a very emotional individual. John Landy, when I met him, he was the governor of Victoria, which is largely a ceremonial role, but one that, you know, accords him a mansion in the center of the loveliest park in Melbourne. And, you know, the Governor Landy. And so I met him, and he was wearing, you know, $1,000 suit, and was just the loveliest person. I mean, just a gentleman, kind, intelligent, but not wanting to sort of, you know, show his intelligence, very interested in lots of different things. You know, what was remarkable to me was about him was his will. Like, he just centered his whole life around running and breaking this 4-minute mile. He pushed training methods far beyond what other people were doing. He clocked more miles. He did 2-a-day runs. He was doing, you know, fartlek training and then interval training and running up and down beaches and doing everything possible that he could do. And it was really just a tremendous, lovely person.
Well, yeah, definitely unique characters, one and all there. And you think about, as you talked about Sir Roger Bannister and I get the image of the two of you walking around that track and he's probably recounting to you that day, right? Like the day where he's out there for the time trial and they have the pacemakers ready to go and the crowd is around him. And is this going to be the day? And,
absolutely. I mean, you know, pointing to the, you know, the flag, which still flew there, which was the sort of determinative symbol of whether or not the wind was dying down and they were going to be able to do it on that sort of windy, rainy day of May 6th, 1954. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what was nice about interviewing him and essential, as I said, is that, you know, you find when writing these histories that the people tend to tell the same stories. They have a talk track in their heads about how this unfolded and what happened. And to walk around with Sir Roger on that track and be like, what were you thinking here in lap two, right? Which no one had asked him in 50 years, surely, if even then. And, you know, and you had mentioned, Don, about feeling like you were there when reading it. And I was only able to do that because I was able to ask Sir Roger and Wes and John, you know, what were you thinking, feeling? What was your body doing at this particular moment? And for them, this seminal moment in their lives, they still remembered. I mean, that Bannister could talk about almost each and every second of that race 50 years later.
Yeah, for sure. I would imagine those moments of triumph for Santee, certainly the more on the other side of probably disappointment, although a 4-minute flat mile, I don't want to use the word failure. That's not the right word. It wasn't what he was trying to achieve, but it certainly isn't the worst time that he could have, well, maybe in his mind, it was the worst time that he could have produced, versus a 3:59.99. But, You mentioned that he carried that with him the same way that Bannister carried the triumph with him. And I'm guessing it shaped his life in a lot of ways after that period of his life was over.
Yes. I mean, his whole life was running, right?
Mm-hmm.
From 1952, his sole dedication was to break the 4-minute mile. As I mentioned, there were many impediments put up in front of him that mm-hmm. Wes, that John and Roger did not face. Just to detail a couple of those, I'd mentioned that before, he was running a lot of races. So sometimes he would have to run 3 races in a single day. The mm-hmm. mile, maybe a 5,000 meter, maybe a relay. And then you have the AAU, the Amateur Athletic Union, and all the impediments and travel and restrictions they put on him. His failure is, as he saw it, he definitely saw it as a failure, that he was never able to achieve 4 minutes, colored the rest of his life. And, it was palpable when you interviewed him, how much that still hurt him and mm-hmm. how much he wanted to race against them in person. He mm-hmm. still unequivocally thought that he was the best runner. Like there was no doubt in Wes Santee's mind who was the best. It was just who was given the opportunity. Now you can agree with that or disagree with it, but that is certainly how he felt.
And you can, as you read through the story, you can certainly start to see the pieces that were, he talks about the hurdles, the barriers that were in front of him, and the way that you detail the account of the way the AAU responded to him, sort of creating that barrier. I mean, there was definitely a conflict between him and the leadership of the AAU at the time, and that did not help his cause as he was trying to get into some of these international races and be able to compete against Bannister and Landry. So could you talk a little bit about that you mentioned it briefly, but that conflict that he felt like was really separating him from having a clean shot at this challenge?
Yeah. I mean, it was, the best way of putting it is that the AAU just never put all the stars in alignment for him to be able to achieve 4 minutes. And so that means that, they didn't set up races with good enough competition, or they would require him to run over in Europe at this point and then come back and then run in this race and then this race. By virtue of the fact that he was a collegiate runner. Mm-hmm. The main issue with the AAU and Santee was the bans that they ultimately put on him because of what they considered the violation of his amateur contract. Mm-hmm. I think at one point he took a camera as a prize for winning a race, and the AAU, came down on him like a hammer for that. The fact of the matter is, they did not. If they would have been on his side behind him, I think he would have had a much better chance at breaking 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And just to sort of give a reason what the issue was with Wes Santee, I think it crystallizes itself probably best in Santee's nickname, which was the Dizzy Dean of the Cinders. He was a national figure. He was very entertaining. He was kind of one of those, he was kind of a Babe Ruth figure, sort of say he's going to run, a 4:02 and wipe the competition away. And he would do exactly that. Mm-hmm. So he got a lot of press. He got a lot of attention. He was invited to a lot of races. He had power, much like, any supremely talented athlete who's at the top of his game has today. But at that time, the amateur, the AAU was threatened by him. And ultimately, its leadership decided to get in his way.
Mm-hmm. And looking at the fact that after Helsinki, I don't believe the three men ever raced together again in the same competition. Correct me if I'm wrong there, but Landy and Bannister did go on to race at least one other time that I'm aware of. Mm-hmm. Folks, if listeners haven't had a chance to watch the video of Bannister breaking the 4 minute barrier, is available on YouTube and other places, as is the showdown between Bannister and Landy. And it's definitely worth taking the 4 minutes as it is to watch those races. But just to think about that showdown after they had both broken the 4 minute mile, Landy and Bannister get together on the track, on the oval, to go head to head. And it was shortly after Bannister broke 4 minutes that Landy bested his time in his own effort to go under 4 minutes. Can you talk to the audience a little bit about that experience for those two men when they were on the track together?
Absolutely. So Bannister breaks the 4 minute mile on May 6th, 1954. Mm-hmm. 6 weeks later, in Scandinavia, Landy breaks 4 minutes. I think it's 3:58.2 or something along those mm-hmm. lines. It's been 20 years since I wrote this. And
the memory still holds. That's,
you know,
that's correct.
Après moi, le deluge was the expression that I think Bannister said, you know, after me, you know, the flood of runners who are going to break 4 minutes. But the fact of the matter is, Bannister broke 4 minute mile in a paced, you know, run, you know, mm-hmm. he had two runners with him. So some people called into question, you know, I think illegitimately, but there was called into question, you know, was that a legitimate run? And I think in the minds of these athletes and many in the sport is, okay, well, you both broke 4 minutes, but who's the best, mm-hmm. you know, in face-to-face competition? And what is remarkable, and the title of the book, The Perfect Mile, is not actually about Bannister breaking 4 minutes. The Perfect Mile is about a race in Vancouver at the Empire Games where Landy and Bannister face off against each other. It is one of the most remarkable mile races you'll ever see. Again, you can probably find it on YouTube. It takes less than 4 minutes too, because they both broke 4 minutes at that race. And it is just an incredibly, you know, nail biter. And, you know, both of those athletes didn't know who was the best. I mean, at that point, and they both felt like this was the ultimate test. Mm-hmm. Same track, same time, who would come out on top. And their race, that win by one of the athletes, is really what The Perfect Mile is about.
Yeah, it's definitely worth the watch as well. Thanks for that explanation. I think that's that race and the outcome, the conclusion of that race and the tactics that were involved in it were pretty spectacular. So we're going to leave the listeners hanging a little bit. If you want to find out who won that race, if you don't already know, go out and watch that video. Before we flip to the final segment here and find out a little bit more about what you've got going on today and what you're working on next, I do want to also just touch base on Race of the Century, which released in 2022, a Scholastic Foundation book. What would you like to say about that title?
Yeah, so with all my adult narrative nonfiction books, I've since started releasing, or with Scholastic releasing, a young adult version of that, and for high school readers, junior high readers. And I wanted to do The Perfect Mile 20 years ago. You know, I thought it was just I wish there had been a young adult book about the 4 minute mile when I was given the chance to hear about Bannister. Mm-hmm. From my coach. And so I just thought it was an incredible opportunity to have this one of the most inspirational sports stories there are out there. Available to young readers, and to really just get to know these three runners, their methods, their tactics, the history of miling. And so it was, I'm super proud of it, and it's found a great audience. And yeah, I mean, it's a boiled down version of The Perfect Mile for younger readers.
Yeah, that's great to hear. When I was a youth track and field coach, our season would always start in early May, right around the time that, the Bannister broke the 4-minute mile. And so I would stand in front of a group of 90 to 150 athletes, however many we had on the club at the time. And I would talk to them about Roger Bannister breaking the 4-minute mile. And I'd ask, show of hands, how many of you have heard of Roger Bannister? And there would be, you know, kids that are 6-year-old to 12-year-old in the audience that are part of the team, and their parents and their grandparents are standing around the gathering and listening as well. And sure enough, grandpa's hand shoots up, a couple of mom and dads who are avid runners, their hand shoot up, but the kids didn't really know. So this is definitely going to fill a hole for a generation that this running history is important. And as you look at the 4-minute mile and what it is today, there are so many comparatively, it's still the holy grail of running, but there are so many more athletes breaking that barrier at the collegiate level every year, at the high school level. In 2022, I think it was broken 7 times on the outdoor track and then a handful more on the indoor track. And so far this year, that number looks to be growing. As Alan Webb pointed out to me, there have been 103 sub-4-minute miles this year on the indoor track.
Wow.
Yeah, on the indoor track this year. And so, we're in outdoor season right now, and we've got NCAAs coming up, and then the Diamond League's getting ready to start. So we're going to see a lot of fast times on the track. And, you know, there's a whole nother discussion about the conditions, cinder track versus the tracks that we're running on today and the speed that those provide, talking about the running shoes with the carbon plates, so many other factors that just weren't contributing to the success that the three gentlemen that we just talked about, Bannister, Santee, and Landy, had, as they were sort of pioneering a lot of the tactics that are used today to achieve those goals. So I want to thank you for that portion. In just a minute, we're going to come back with segment 3, and we'll talk about what you've got going on right now and what you're looking to do in the future. Okay, we are back for segment 3 with Neil Bascom, author of The Perfect Mile. Neil, thanks for sharing some insight about the protagonists of your book, about the experience that you had with it. I think there's a lot of people who listen that are now thinking about what it would be like to walk around the track with that influential person, or maybe run a mile with Prefontaine, or opening the imagination to those types of things that maybe they hadn't before. What are you working on now? What are some of the other things that are keeping your literary fire burning and the projects that you have on the horizon?
Yeah, I'm sort of juggling a few things, right now. One, I just sort of put in the can, my first YA original nonfiction history, which is about, Gandhi's, march, in 1930, which was about 140 miles, to pick up contraband salt as a sort of symbolic resistance against the British Raj. And so it's kind of the origin story of Gandhi's nonviolent movement, and it's an endurance story. And so right now I've spent about 3 years on it, and I just finished it, and just finished the editing, and it'll come out next year. So I'm very proud of that. I started about a year ago something, a sort of passion project called Workcraft Life. It's a newsletter. You can find it on my website, neilbascom.com. It's about, it's a weekly, or actually bi-weekly, newsletter about people and their work. And so I profile someone every other week, whether it's a plumber or a professional athlete or soldier or nurse or a death doula, whatever it is, and just profile what their work life looks like, how they got into it. And I'm just fascinated by sort of the array of things that people do.
For sure.
And then finally, I'm just developing my first television show with the studio, a historical sort of spy thriller, and with a couple people who actually know what they're doing, a couple of professional, well-established TV writers, and so that again is a very different itch that I'm scratching, something new that I'm trying. You know, after writing 15 books, I felt like I wanted to try something a little bit different and explore different avenues with my writing. And so that's what I'm doing. And it's been very fun. It's been very challenging. And I'll return to doing my nonfiction books, you know, soon, I suspect.
Fantastic. Yeah. Don't give up that craft. You're an excellent writer, and we want to read everything that you can put out, for sure. And it's super exciting that you're going to be involved in a television show as well. I'm guessing at this point it's too early to give any other details on what that might look like.
But it's just in the sort of development phase. I've sold it, and now it's just it's happening. And the other big project is I'm climbing Kilimanjaro in July, so that's what I'm doing in terms of my athletic training. I'm walking. You know, my children look at me weird because I walk around the house in my 20-pound backpack all the time, trying to acclimate myself to wearing a backpack all the time. And it's again a different kind of athletic endeavor, but one that is fun.
Well, great, and we'll look forward to hearing that story from you in the future of how that trip went and how the ascent up Mount Kilimanjaro went for you. And also a nice teaser for the listeners to be on the lookout for that TV show in the future. So I know that you're super busy, Neil, so I will let you get on with your day. I do appreciate you coming on to the Run Nerd Library podcast and talking with us today. Thanks for your time, and any parting shots on your end?
No, I just, this has been wonderful to talk, Don, about Perfect Mile. Again, like I said, it's one of these perfect stories. And, you know, they set it up for me, and I just sort of was able to give it all to you. If you want to learn more about the newsletter or about the Gandhi book, again, you can go to my website, neilbascom.com.
Thank you for tuning in to the fifth episode of the Run Nerd Library podcast. I had a great time chatting with Neil Bascom, New York Times best-selling author of a total of 15 books now, including his forthcoming book on Gandhi. Our discussion covered specifically The Perfect Mile as we dove into the story of Roger Bannister, Wes Santee, and John Landy in a three-way quest to be the first man to break the four-minute mile. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and thank you for taking time to tune in, including our listeners from right here in the United States and overseas in Spain, England, Germany, and Thailand. Appreciate you taking time out of your day to listen to the podcast, and we look forward to having you on for a future edition.